Welcome to Spies of London with Paul Detman. This is our third episode in the new format. Hope you're enjoying it. We start with a couple of factoids. We have the main piece, which is 15 to 20 minutes, a short book review, and some more factoids. I've been saying in recent episodes, if you have a USB microphone, if you want to send us a book review, get in touch and I will help to facilitate that. Absolutely happy to have guest hosts taking the book review slot, and then we're also planning some interviews later in the autumn. Today's factoid: news that Guy Burgess of the Cambridge Spy Ring is in fact related to the Burgess ice cream family of Beverley, East Yorkshire. No, that's not true. So today's main piece is really part two. Following on from last week's about MI6 buildings, we are looking today at MI5 buildings. On my Mayfair walk, we have Leconfield House, which was the headquarters of MI5 when it was still in the shadows and when John le Carré worked there. Today it's at Thames House, and it was actually at Thames House in the past. It's bounced back and forth a few times before landing there, and Thames House is massive. It's got thousands of staff today, and it's got a beautiful view of the Thames from Millbank. It's down the road from the old Labour Party headquarters and overlooked by the TV station Russia Today. Thames House is really dramatic. It's completely different to Vauxhall Cross, where MI6 has its glass and steel, what's the word for that building? The ziggurat. One of the former MI5 locations, Gower Street, 140 Gower Street, has been demolished, so that cannot feature on any walk, and that's one of the problems with a physical spy walk. We can take you on a virtual tour of Gower Street anytime, but you cannot go and see that building for yourself, unfortunately. One of the reasons I like to look at the buildings is because you can tell some high-level information just from the street. If you walk past Thames House today, and I particularly enjoyed this at tea time on a weeknight in autumn when it's getting dark, the leaves are brown and golden, some of them are swishing around your ankles, and it's the staff leaving hour. The people who come out of Thames House are literally like you and me. They don't look like spies at all. And I think that's important. It shows that it's a professional office environment, which most days is perfectly routine. It's just an office at the end of the day. And I think it's what goes on outside of the office, on location, on the streets, behind the scenes, that is what draws us in as outsiders to that fascinating life. But what you can tell from Thames House is that this is a very large and well-equipped organisation with thousands of staff, and they now have an office in the northwest as well, of course. In 1925, MI5 had 35 staff or officers. By early 1939, 14 years later, it had 36 officers. So something happened during and after World War II that completely changed the nature of MI5. MI5 is responsible for security on the mainland of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, but they have no powers of arrest, so they cannot take people off the street without the cooperation of the police. And although they are responsible for the security of Great Britain, they do get involved in overseas actions. But clearly, MI5 does not have, and has never had, the exotic cachet of MI6, the overseas intelligence agency. The people who, at least in our common mythology, put people in harm's way on a daily basis and dash around with guns in hot and really exciting locations. MI5 agents usually are sitting in a Morrison's car park with a pair of binoculars if they're lucky. So much for the myth. As always, there's some truth in that and a lot of falsehood, a lot of misunderstanding. MI5 agents have been involved in dangerous operations overseas. But there has always been this overlap and disconnect and parity, all of those contradictory words that you could use to try and explain that tracking baddies is never a clean-cut case of, well, this operation is an MI6 thing, this one is MI5 because it's mainly based in Britain, this one is GCHQ because it's mainly electronic surveillance. That has never been easy. And I used to say to people on the walk, MI6 tracks people at long range over a long time, and it's the kind of early warning system. And as an event or an attack or some problem comes closer in time, perhaps the agents, the terrorists, whoever they are, arrive in Britain to carry out whatever it is they're planning. Responsibility then hands over to MI5. And then when it comes time to arrest people, that hands over to the police. And in theory and in fact, MI6, MI5 and GCHQ and the police are supposed to cooperate and collaborate in a seamless fashion. Anyone who has experience of the public sector, or indeed the private sector, knows that large organisations find it hard to collaborate seamlessly, especially when the stakes are high. So looking at the recent Manchester bomb attack on the music concert, it turns out that the police, fire brigade, MI5, everybody made mistakes, ambulance service, everybody made mistakes. Everybody seems at the inquest to be trying to massage their role in it. And you can see why, because when the inquest happens, first of all, that's bad news. You don't have an inquest if it's gone well. What you tend to find, as with any other walk of life, is that blame starts to get attached. And what you need to make sure is that you and your organisation don't get the blame, or at least they don't get as much of the blame as another organisation. This has happened with the corona crisis. It happened with the financial crisis. It happens every time there's a crisis. There's a flood, there's a fire, Grenfell. People are trying to divert and deflect blame. And that runs through certainly British culture and probably Western culture and the rest of the world too. Nobody wants to get blamed. Nobody wants to take charge. So when you have a larger, complex investigation, all of the agencies are supposed to be represented and at different times, but sometimes things go wrong. The reason I mention this now is that it was never certain that MI5 and MI6 would become the two main security organisations in this country. You can tell that from the numbers. MI9, which was responsible for escape and evasion and getting people out of camps like Colditz during the war, clearly had no purpose once the war was over. One day I'll do an episode on MI1, MI2 and all the rest of them, but you get the feeling that there is a potential future where there is only one service which covers MI5 and 6 and GCHQ and possibly has powers of arrest like the American FBI as well. Or there's a future where there's more than these two or three services. They could be split up. And all the time that that is at least theoretically possible, you will get the situation where people are trying to protect their own organisation, even if it's the detriment of another one. Added to this is that MI5 is responsible to the Home Office, whereas MI6 is responsible to the Foreign Office, which again sets up budgetary constraints and differences in leadership at the top level, which can filter down through the ranks. So it was never guaranteed that MI5 would become the British Security Service. There has never been a British Secret Service officially. There is the Secret Intelligence Service, MI6, and the Security Service, MI5. There is no organisation with the official name Secret Service. But together, MI5, MI6 and GCHQ could be considered the British Secret Service. In other words, relatively off the grid. Certainly until 1994, they were never officially acknowledged, although everybody knew they existed. But this phrase that's used now, plausible deniability, helped them to get away with things that perhaps they wouldn't have been able to do today or in the past if they had been officially accountable and transparent in the way that perhaps the police and fire brigade have to be, and to a lesser extent the regular military as well. And also during Second World War there was SOE, the Special Operations Executive, which shows that during a specific crisis a new organisation can materialise. And then at the end of the war, it was never guaranteed that SOE would be disbanded. It could have been rebranded and modified, but it could have continued. It just so happened that the politics which had riven it right through the war got the better of it, and it got disbanded largely, and the people who were not let go were merged into MI6. So this paints a picture of uncertainty, especially at times of war and internal political crisis of any kind, like the Northern Ireland Troubles, for example. This all goes to show that MI5's existence as the prime homeland security service, the Americans would call it homeland security, was never guaranteed at any point in its past and certainly isn't guaranteed today. So with that brief overview behind us, we can now look more closely at the buildings. Something I didn't know is that MI5 was based at Watergate House in the Strand from 1912 until 1916. That was when it moved to 16 Charles Street for the rest of the First World War. After that war, it moved to Queen's Gate in 1919 and then to Cromwell Road in 1929. Remember that this was when it was just 30 odd people, so nothing like the organisation of today. It's in 1934 when MI5 first arrives at Thames House on Millbank. Now, it's certain that Thames House back then was the same size it is now. It's quite clearly a building with some status and some history. But if there were only 30-odd people, it's pretty obvious that it didn't take the whole building. And I understand it just took part of the top floor of what's called the South Block, which is the block currently occupied. Now, that's where things get really interesting, because in the Second World War, obviously London was getting heavily bombed. So MI5 moved out first to Wormwood Scrubs Prison and then further out to Blenheim Palace in 1940. Now, it's pretty clear that it grew substantially during the war. That growth, as we saw with SOE a moment ago, was not guaranteed to carry on. Those people could easily have been redeployed after the war. But in fact, in 1945 was when MI5 moved to Leconfield House, which puts it into Mayfair on Curzon Street and into My Mayfair Walk. And it stayed there for 30 years until 1976. So these offices do not move often. It was at Leconfield House throughout John le Carré's career there, through John Bingham's career, and people like Guy Liddell, Thomas Harris, Kim Philby all worked at some time or another in Leconfield House. It moved to 140 Gower Street in 1976, since demolished, where it stayed until 1994, when it returned to Thames House, this time to occupy the entire building. And there is now a Northern Operations Centre for MI5 in Greater Manchester. Now, that is a response to domestic terrorism, but also to the reality that to secure such a large island as Great Britain requires detailed intelligence beyond London. And I think one of the weaknesses of MI5, as shown by the Manchester bomb, is that it can be too large to respond efficiently. So the new Northern Operations Centre is certainly a step in the right direction. And just recently, some smaller departments, like the Northern Ireland Office, have moved out of Thames House to give MI5 even more space. It seems to me that the earlier heads of MI5 were far more colourful and memorable than the current ones. Some famous ones who jump out at me, after Vernon Kell, who was the first one from 1909 to 1940, a long time, are Sir Percy Sillitoe, who ran it for 7 years in the late 40s, Dick White, Roger Hollis, who Peter Wright fingered as a spy, never been proved or admitted by anybody, Stella Rimington, who was the first female head of MI5 in the early 90s, Eliza Manningham Buller, Dame Manningham Buller, whose father was in the Secret Service as well, and then more recently Andrew Parker, who has just recently given it up to a guy called Ken McCallum. But it's really Vernon Kell, Dick White, Hollis, would have been Kim Philby in a parallel universe, who stand out as the founding fathers, the people who really got MI5 going and sustained it after the war as well. So that's a brief history, a brief look at MI5 through its buildings. You can see Thames House on my Thames Walk, the Westminster Walk, and Leconfield House on the Mayfair Walk. Gower Street, we can see Gower Street, but unfortunately the building itself has gone. Just before we hand over to Paul for this week's book review, we have our final factoid. Did you know that Guy Burgess had dinner with Donald MacLean on the night they escaped Britain? That's not the factoid. The factoid is that Guy Burgess was introduced as a man called Roger Stiles. Roger Stiles is a made-up name, quite obviously, but it's made up from two names used by Agatha Christie. Roger Ackroyd was one of her murder victims, and The Affair at Stiles was one of her books, hence Roger Stiles. Anybody who had ever read Agatha Christie would have immediately rung the Foreign Office. And now, without further ado, let's hand over to Paul for his review of Roland Phillips, A Spy Named Orphan, The Enigma of Donald MacLean. Thanks, Paul. So I first read this book when it came out as an e-book, and it is extremely well written. It's very readable. Strongly recommend it. But this copy is the hardback that I have in my hand, which was given to me indirectly from a deceased person I never met. Friend who was clearing out the house, saw the book, knew that I was into spies and suggested I could take it. And I'm really pleased that I did, because the hardback is so much nicer than the Kindle version. The first thing to note is that inside the covers, there is printed a top secret memo which records the final days in Britain of Donald MacLean, with times, coded references and cross-references. This is clearly an official government document which has been released from the archives and it shows that at 7:30 p.m. McLean introduced Guy Burgess to Mrs. McLean as Roger Stiles. They announced that after dinner they would be going off to see somebody else and might be away the whole night. Neither of them were ever seen again, at least not in Britain. Roland Phillips is a professional publisher working for John Murray. He is not a writer. This is his first book. It's brilliant, and it's a real shame he hasn't written more. It's very readable, really well done. And it's produced by Bodley Head Vintage of Vauxhall Bridge Road, which is the road where MI6 is. So I really wanted to grab this book the second it came out because Donald McLean is something of an enigma, as the title suggests. I think there are several reasons for this. One is that he was a very serious career man, a very successful person, whereas the guy he escaped with, Guy Burgess, was an outlandish character, a gambler, a drinker, a party animal, very outgoing. So Guy Burgess eclipsed virtually everybody who knew him, and he had a very mixed reputation. People either loved Guy Burgess or they hated him, and many people went off him as his behaviour got more and more outlandish. So Guy Burgess stands tall as a character. Kim Philby was famous because he was so senior in the Secret Service, and because of his press conference where he said he was innocent, and because he got the Prime Minister to state that he was innocent. Philby was always the media player, and able to manipulate the media, whereas McLean was a very private man. And I think these things together, plus the fact that he escaped at the same time as Burgess, means that he's always lumped together as almost as one person, as they do on, you know, Instagram now, where there's a famous couple and you merge their two names to get one name and people just call them using that one mixed up name. So Burgess and McLean, and it always does seem to be Burgess and McLean, it's never McLean and Burgess. Burgess and McLean almost became one spy. This is interesting because McLean didn't really know Guy Burgess. They spent very little time together until they escaped, of course. People say that Burgess was meant to come home, that he was meant to be escorting and helping McLean, but he was meant to return, and he decided at the last minute to stay away. And of course, soon after their escape, the finger of suspicion pointed to Kim Philby, who then stole the limelight for the next few years. And I think these things together tend to lead us away from the McLean story. Because Philby and Burgess and the famous Anthony Blunt steal the headlines, the two who get forgotten are always McLean and Cairncross. And I think in these kind of stories, it's better for you and your family and your friends if you're the one who gets forgotten. So I think McLean's family obviously had an interest in making sure that his story was misremembered or disremembered in the mists of time. But another particular reason I had for wanting to focus on McLean was that he is buried a few miles from my house in Penn Churchyard, and I went to see his grave in 2018 as a result of this book coming out. And I have to say, my photo, which I'll put on the website, is a much better photo than the one in the book. Mine's in colour for a start, but it's clear to me that the text on the memorial of Donald McLean's father and Donald himself and some other family members has been refreshed and polished, and is much clearer today than it was when this photo in the book was taken. The flaps say here that Ronald Phillips had a lifelong connection to Donald McLean and his story. I'm not surprised. I think most of the British establishment had some kind of connection to the McLean family. So Donald McLean, Donald Duart McLean, was a family man with a wife, Melinda, and two sons, Donald and Fergus. And I think this sets him apart as well. Kim Philby was married, but was never commented on as a family man, a true father. Burgess certainly not, and Blunt not at all either. So he was quiet, he was professional, he was committed to his cause, he was a family man, his father was part of the British establishment, and he's drifted into the mists of time. And I think this book, more than any other book about Donald McLean, really brings that home. It says on the back cover that he was a diplomat, a husband, a patriot, a traitor, a deceiver, and a spy. He was all of those things. He was a massive contradiction, and this is a very well written, well researched, detailed book, but it is still very readable. So I strongly recommend this to you, either the ebook, the audiobook, or the hardback. I particularly enjoyed the hardback. I think it's a really nice edition. But I strongly recommend it to you. If you want to learn more about the Cambridge Five, obviously the others do make an appearance, but I think Donald McLean has been less well served by books and papers than both Burgess and Philby, and to a lesser extent Blunt as well. So that's all I have for you this week. Please do give us a follow, add a review on your favourite podcast app. Remember, these podcasts are completely free forever for you to download and listen to wherever you like to listen to your podcasts. Spies of London will return.